Good to see you out this evening. On Sunday nights, we've been looking at the inspired writings of the Apostle John, and it's been a sort of a journey. We started out with John's Gospel. We then covered 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, the three epistles that he wrote by inspiration. And now the last thing we have recorded of his inspired writings, the book of Revelation. So we'll begin tonight looking at the book of Revelation. Let's look a little bit about the man first, the Apostle John. He had probably, as far as men go, probably the closest relationship with Christ that any man had. In John chapter 13, it says, when Jesus had washed the disciples' feet, and they all had reclined at the table to eat the meal, there was one who was leaning upon Jesus' bosom. It was one of his disciples whom Jesus loved. And we have an interesting picture here. Of course, when they ate at the table, they did not use chairs in the way that we do, but they reclined in order to eat. And reclining at the table, you would be, everyone would sort of recline in one direction, like shingles on a roof, I guess you'd say, going this way. And next to Christ there at the table, next to him was John, and John was leaning in the direction of Christ. And it says reclining on his bosom, or leaning on his bosom. It showed his position at the table there, and that he was leaning in the direction of Christ. And this would be a favored place. This is where you would want your best friend, because they would be so easy to talk with. And he's called here in John 13 the disciple whom Jesus loved. That doesn't mean that Jesus did not love the other disciples, but it does mean there was something special between John and Jesus Christ, and there was indeed. How do you explain that? It's really pretty simple. Look around, think about the people here in the Greenville congregation. And if we were to say, well, do you love all of them? I know you would say yes. I know that. But are there some of them that you really especially enjoy being around? That when you're around them, things just sort of click. You enjoy their personality, and you and they just get along really good. And of course there are. There are people we get along with better than others, not because we don't love those other people, but because of personalities. And certain personalities just seem to work together very, very well. And I believe that's what's being indicated here. This is someone with whom Jesus Christ really connected, personality-wise, and they got along so well. Does not mean that Jesus did not love the other apostles. He loved them all. Jesus trusted John. And trust is trust, but when you take a family member and turn them over to someone else's care, that's trust. And what if that family member was your mother? And that's exactly what happened in John 19. Jesus shows his trust for John. When Jesus was hanging up on the cross, he saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing thereby. And he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." And then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, that disciple took her into his own home. What a great trust that Jesus had in his apostle here, John, in order to turn the care of his mother over to this man. And it was returned as well. Notice that the care that was to be given to Mary here would be done in John's own home. he would take her into his own home for this care. And that's really caring for someone. John is called the author of Revelation sometimes. I would rather, and I don't think you would want to call him author either. We don't really want to use that term. Author, I looked it up to make sure that I wasn't thinking incorrectly. Author means the composer of a literary work, according to the dictionary. A composer of a literary work. An author is not, the dictionary says, he is not a compiler or a translator or a copyist, but he is the composer of the work. John is not the author of the book of Revelation. He is an inspired writer. He is an instrument for putting the words on paper. He is an appointed scribe, but not the author. John wrote Revelation while he was in exile on the Isle of Patmos. Why was he exiled? Because he was preaching the gospel. And we'll get into more of this later, that in fact it was against the law to be a Christian at this time. So here we have him exiled to the Isle of Patmos, and there alone, and his dear beloved friend, Jesus Christ. And you know Christ coming to him in this vision, rejoiced to come to his good friend John and reveal this vision to him. There are many, many speculations about the date of the writing of Revelation. I could talk 20 minutes about this person speculates this date of writing, and another person says, no, this is the date and this is why. And we could study for hours on that, really. And we'd leave the building tonight not knowing any more about the date of its writing than we did when we came in. Folks, let's don't speculate. Let's don't speculate. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of time. And nothing is gained by speculation. There's the things the Bible doesn't tell us, we don't need to guess at them. And the what ifs. You know, if I can just understand what the Bible tells me, I would be so blessed. I don't need to go out there after other things that I don't know. I just want to understand the simple facts of the Bible. So we're not going to speculate in the study of Revelation. We're not going to do that. And it may make the study less colorful to you and less exciting, less dramatic, if we don't do a lot of speculating. But you did notice the title of the lesson is The Simple Approach to Revelation. And we're going to keep it simple. We're going to keep it simple. Let's do some comparison. You know, if we look at the book of Genesis and look at the book of Revelation, they are at opposite ends of the spectrum in so many ways. And they're at opposite ends of our Bible, aren't they? Let me read you some things here that we've noticed about Genesis and Revelation. In the Garden of Eden, of course, that's Genesis, Satan was victorious over Adam and Eve by making them, tempting them and getting them to sin. But in Revelation, Satan is defeated. So we've got a victorious Satan in Revelation and a defeated Satan in Revelation. Quite a contrast. Another one, because of Adam and Eve's sin, man was banished from the tree of life. But in heaven, we will have the right to the tree once again. Man was banished from Eden, but he will be admitted into heaven to enjoy that tree of life again. It's like a return, isn't it? A return to where the Father started us out as mankind. Here's another one. Death came upon all men due to sin, but in heaven there is no more death and no more suffering. What a relief that will be. In the world, we have hardships with tears, but in heaven, all tears shall be wiped away. Adam and Eve were shut out of the Garden of Eden. And you know, the Garden of Eden was like, some have said, it's sort of like heaven on earth. Now, it was not heaven, don't get me wrong, but we use that phrase figuratively, heaven on earth. And the Garden of Eden must have been something like heaven on earth. They were shut out of it when they were taken out of it, sent out of it, and they were shut out of it. But the gates of eternal heaven will be open to the faithful. On one case, we have the gates being shut behind them, and now the gates open up once again. The angels kept man from re-entering into the Garden of Eden, but angels will welcome man into heaven. Look, quite a contrast there. In the world, God's face is unseen, but in heaven, all shall see him. We'll see Christ as he really is. In the world, we must deal with darkness, but there is no darkness in heaven because Christ is the light thereof. There never will be darkness or nighttime in heaven. I've had several people come and say, I'm glad you're doing this thing on Revelation because I've read it and I've never understood any of it. It's the most misunderstood book in the Bible. The most misunderstood book in the Bible. It is the most misquoted book in the Bible. Misapplied, verses being misapplied, misused, and abused. The book has really had a hard life. It's been treated pretty roughly by those reading it. Some say that Revelation is speaking of current day events. I've even had people point out, well, you know, you heard that in the news. Well, in Revelation it says this is going to happen, you know. Some say, well, Revelation is talking about things that are happening today, and, you know, that just shows us that the end must be near. Some have misused Revelation to make money. Some have written books about it, books that are scary and cause people to panic, and they write these books and get them publicized and sent out, and they make a lot of money going around talking in seminars and selling their books and misusing the book of Revelation. How does a Christian answer the outlandish interpretations of Revelation? Now, we should be able to answer questions about the Bible. We should know it well enough. And I realize Revelation is a challenge to us sometimes. But when someone makes outlandish claims about something and misusing Revelation to support an outlandish claim, how does a Christian answer? Most of the time, I believe we don't answer. We let it slide because, well, after all, it's the book of Revelation, and it's hard. And Christians have for a long time viewed Revelation to be so mysterious and so far out of reach to us to understand it that we've not defended the truth, even when false teaching is being promoted by misusing Revelation. So we need to get an idea of what Revelation is all about and understand it so that we might be able to stand up and tell others what it is teaching. Let's look at some terms that are frequently associated with the book of Revelation. The apocalypse. Have you ever seen any of the movies that come out? They call them apocalyptic movies. And what are they about? They're about the earth got all blown to pieces by some war, and now the post-apocalyptic time is there, and it may be ruled by robots or cockroaches. I don't know whichever way they want to do the movie, but you get the idea. And so what do we picture, you know, in our minds when we think about the apocalypse? You sort of picture a big explosions and the earth being just blown to bits. No, that's not it at all. That's so far away from the Bible. And what the Bible means is it's just way out there. Before Revelation was ever called Revelation, it was called the Apocalypse of John. The Apocalypse of John. That's the first name for it right there. In the minds of most people, apocalypse means the coming and the imminent and complete and ultimate destruction of all things. Dead wrong. There's just no way at all. That's right. Apocalypse comes from the Greek word apokalypsis, and apokalypsis means to reveal. I told you it's going to be the simple approach. Isn't that boring? Apocalypsis means to reveal. Well, I wonder where we got the name for the book calling it Revelation. Could it have been from the definition of apocalypsis, to reveal? Absolutely. If you look in Thayer's Bible Dictionary, apocalypsis means it is a disclosure of truth and instruction. That's what apocalypsis means. So when we go to chapter 1, verse 1, it says, the revelation of Jesus Christ. Well, look in the Greek there, and it says, the apocalypsis of Jesus Christ. There's nothing bad about it. It doesn't mean that something's going to blow up in your face. It simply means the revelation of Jesus Christ. It's a beautiful thing. It's not a war, an explosion, and the end of all things that we know. Apocalypsis is Jesus Christ revealing truth and instruction to us. And that's what it means. And isn't that simple? Isn't that simple? Let's don't make things complicated. Let's get down to what the truth really is about Revelation and make it really simple, and it is. All right, let's go to the Antichrist next, the Antichrist. Some think the Antichrist will come, and this will be a worldwide event. Everybody will know it. Here he is. And he's going to set off a chain reaction of all these other events in the world, and things are just going to start falling to pieces to the point that one day we're going to have the apocalypse and it's all just going to blow up. Well, the Antichrist is going to have a part in that, starting that out. Wrong. That's just dead wrong. The Antichrist is mentioned 5 times in the Bible. Yeah, it's in the Bible, mentioned 5 times. It is not mentioned in Revelation a single time. Not even once. Antichrist is a term that only John uses. Now, the author of Revelation, not author, I said that before, he is the writer of Revelation. He is the only one that uses the term Antichrist. He uses it in the epistles of 1st and 2nd John, and that's where we find the 5 times that it is used. John uses the term, and one of these times, it is plural. Now, plural means more than one. If I say dog, that's one, right? If I say dogs, That's more than one, right, kids? We used to learn those things in school. I don't know if you do that anymore or not. But plural means more than one. Usually got an S on the end of the word to make it plural, more than one. Now, one of these five times that the word Antichrist is used by the writer John is in 1 John 2:18. And there in that verse, he says, many antichrists. Well, you put the S on the end of it, that means antichrist, that means more than one. And you put the word, the adjective, many in front of it, and that means not just is there more than one, but there's many of them, many of them. He is not, the Antichrist is not an individual, a one that is going to come and do certain things. There are many Antichrists at the time of John's writing. Now, let's let the Bible tell us about Antichrist. Let's not use our own opinions. Let's don't use what some man has said in a book. If you've got books at home that certain people have written about a Revelation that are not Bible-based, and I mean every sentence in it Bible-based, throw that book away. It's just going to confuse you, and I would get rid of that book. Now, there are some good commentaries on Revelation, and they're out there. But be careful what books you read. Let's go to the Bible and see what it says. The writings of John give the definition of the Antichrist. We don't really have to look in a dictionary to find them, but let's just go to the Bible and see what John says about Antichrist. In 1 John 2, verse 22, John tells us, describe to us the Antichrist. He is Antichrist who denies the Father and the Son. He just described him. And now, could it be more than one? Yes. What, could it be a lady? Why, it could, couldn't it? Tell me again, John, give me the definition for Antichrist. He is Antichrist who denies the Father and the Son. If you deny God and you deny his Son, even today, you are Antichrist. Right? Here's another one. John, 1 John 4:3. John's going to tell us some more about the Antichrist. He does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh. So he's an Antichrist. What does he not do? He doesn't confess that Jesus Christ, the Christ, has come in the flesh. The Jews that stuck with Judaism rather than being converted over to Christianity would not confess that Jesus was indeed the Son of God, the Christ. They wouldn't do it. They were Antichrist because of that. What about today? Could I properly say someone today who does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh, and could I call him an Antichrist? I could, yes. I wouldn't. It's not a way to make friends and influence people, is it? And if I want to talk to him and teach him better, I'm not going to insult him. Here's another one from John, 2 John 1:7. John, again, is going to tell us a little more description of the Antichrist. And he here says, he is a deceiver. He is a deceiver, a false teacher. The writings of John give a time frame for the Antichrist. And we might say, well, no, the Antichrist is going to be someone who somewhere down the road, we don't know when exactly, but the Antichrist is going to show up. And we even make jokes about it. Well, I think old so-and-so's the Antichrist, don't you? You know, like we're expecting him to show up and surface one day. Well, John says in 1 John 2:18, even now many Antichrists have come. When, John? Even now, at the time of the writing of these writings in Revelation here, or this one in the book, in the letter of 1 John, he says, even now the Antichrist have come. Well, they're already there. They're already there. Have they always been with us? Are they with us today? Well, sure. In 1 John 4:3, it's talking about the Antichrist and it says, he is now already in the world. Already. They're already present. Antichrist isn't necessarily talking about, it isn't the name of a person, but it's talking about a type of person. A type of person. We might have, yeah, we got a few more minutes. Armageddon. Big war. And it's going to just get all stirred up, and the whole world is eventually going to get involved in it. And we're all going to be chucking bombs at each other, and it's just going to be a real big mess. And the Antichrist is probably going to get in there and stir it up, make it even worse. In fact, he probably started this war. And then it's going to get to the point to where it's going to blow everything up, and that's when the apocalypse happens. No. These are all comic book ideas that people have come up with. Throw those old books away that you've got, you might have been reading, and go back into your Bible, and let's really get into Revelation in the Bible. Let's learn it there. Armageddon is mentioned only one time in the Bible. One time. It's in Revelation 16:16. And with that one time, there are those who have taken it and spun it so much that it's turned into a big tornado. And it's just one word in one place. I know every word in the Bible is important, and I believe this word is important. But it's also important that we use it the right way. Some Bibles, and I hope yours does, will footnote that verse, Revelation 16:16. There where the word Armageddon appears, they'll footnote and say the early text reads, and that's going back to the old original language, the early text reads, Megiddo. Well, good. We're getting deeper into the meaning of it here. You see, Armageddon is not an event. It is a place. The whole wrong misconception about Armageddon is it is an event. It has never been an event. Megiddo is a place. It is a literal place on earth. It exists today. You can go to Mount Megiddo today. And well, why is it used in Revelation 16:16? Well, we're going to get into this later, but Revelation uses a lot of symbolic language, a lot of symbols. And it uses Mount Megiddo because that's where so many battles were being fought. Revelation is a book that will show us battlegrounds over and over, and how Christ is always victorious on those battlegrounds. And it refers to Mount Megiddo, where many battles were fought. At least two of them were recorded in the Old Testament. You can go back in the Old Testament and read of battles fought at Mount Megiddo. So in Revelation, Armageddon is a symbolic battleground and nothing more. Nothing more. It's symbolic of the battleground because it was a famous battleground. People have tried to predict the end of the world for centuries. You know, we think about people who have tried to predict the end of the world, and I sort of think about more current day people writing books and, you know, about telling when the world's going to end and so forth. But you might be surprised. There are some people that are very respectable or considered very respectable who have tried to predict the end of the world. They go way back. Christopher Columbus tried to predict the end of the world. Christopher Columbus, Isaac Newton, the old boy that sat under the apple tree and the apple came down and hit him in the head, and he says, you know, I think that's gravity, you know? Well, he tried to predict the end of the world. Martin Luther, very famous for the Reformation movement, did as well. Many Catholic popes have tried to predict the end. And then we get right up to present day religious leaders and the authors of books and promoters of seminars. Might just call them all money makers today, trying to predict the end of the world and then adjusting that date the date comes and nothing happens. But all of them have failed. Jesus said, of that day and of that hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. The Father knows when the end of the world will occur, and no one else. Is the key, is there a formula, is there a combination, or a hidden secret in the book of Revelation that tells us when the end of the world is drawing nigh? No, there is not. There is not. I'm drawing a line in my book right there. Right there's a line. And I'm writing the word start. And that's where we're going to start next time, Lord willing. Check the clock one more time. Make sure I'm right. Yes, I'm right. Now, next Sunday night, we're going to have Dan Bailey's going to be here. Right? Next Sunday night. But Lord willing, the following Sunday night, we will get back onto our study of Revelation. And that will give you some time to study ahead and so forth. And we're going to sit and look at some more keys to understanding the book of Revelation. I'm going to give you some keys. And every time I give you a key, I want you to remember it. So maybe bring you a notebook or some 3x5 cards or something like that so that you can write down what the keys are. And then when we get over there in chapter 16 or whatever of Revelation, and I'm going to say, do you remember your keys? Get your keys out, and we're going to look and have the key that unlocks the mystery of what we're reading about. So I'm going to give you a set of keys to help you understand and help me understand the book of Revelation. Fantastic writing it is, and understandable if we just keep it simple. Tonight, there might be one in our number who has never obeyed the gospel, and we'd like to help you do that if it just means starting a study with you tonight. Or if you're an erring Christian who needs to come back and be restored tonight, we'd love to assist you in doing that. Won't you come while we stand and sing?